Ondertussen hebben we Max Heywood on the line. You can hear us?
Yes, I can hear you well. Good afternoon.
So, first of all, I have to say happy birthday for your organization, because I saw that on the 8th of this month, it existed 20 years.
Yes, absolutely, and thank you very much. That's very kind of you. Yes, it's been a very special year for us and a very special couple of weeks. We had a large conference in Berlin 2 weeks ago, as you say, with all of the founding members of Transparency International who got together again. So it was really a very moving, actually, event to hear the story of how much things have changed and how much things have evolved since they started back in 1993, right?
I hope for the better. You say things have changed. So let's get into that history of your organization shortly. So it started 20 years ago, Transparency International. Who started it and why?
The organization was founded by Peter Eigen, who used to work for the World Bank in East Africa for many years. And he was actually with us in Berlin 2 weeks ago, and he was telling the story himself, which is actually a great experience to hear from him how it went. And the story goes that in the 1970s, 1980s, the international organizations, for example, the World Bank, but also many others such as the OECD, really were not willing to engage directly with corruption. So people working in the countries on the ground, they could see the effects of corruption on their work. For example, money that should have been for a school was spent on something else, or was stolen, or was used for private purposes instead of for what it was intended to be used for. And so they had been talking about this for a long time, but had not been successful in drawing international attention. Corruption was seen as a small issue, perhaps a cultural issue. There was nothing that could be done. For example, this was something that was only affecting developing countries, for example. So in 1993, Peter organized a conference here in Berlin with a small group of people. And as a result of that conference, they formed Transparency International to start investigating and talking about and actually fighting corruption. So that was how the whole thing started. And it's interesting to look at some newspaper headlines from that time. For example, one newspaper said they were like Don Quixote fighting windmills. They said that this would never be successful. So it's quite interesting to look back and see how it was perceived at the time.
What was the aim of the organization? I saw somewhere that it was seen as an advisory council.
Yes, that's going into the details a bit. One of the first things they realized when they started working as Transparency International was that they needed a new and innovative structure, because corruption is almost always, especially large corruption, has an international element. So often there are multinational corporations involved, there are international banks involved, for example. So the founders immediately realized they could not have a traditional headquarters, for example, in London or in Berlin or in Washington, and do all the work there. So what they did was they started to set up a network of what we call national chapters. And these are partner organizations who are in the different countries in which Transparency International works. And at the moment, we have 112 of these national chapters who work together as a network using a common strategy and coordinated by a secretariat, which is in Berlin.
And that's where you are too, yes.
And that's where I'm based, exactly.
So those national chapters, were they created in function of Transparency International, or were they existing local NGOs?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because it's a combination of both. So, for example, our chapter in Argentina is called Poder Ciudadano, and they had existed long before Transparency International was founded. So in that case, they joined the network as an existing NGO. And in other cases over the years, local people got together and said, we want to have a chapter too, and approached Transparency to say, how can we do that? So then they would found an organization. For example, in Mexico, Transparencia Mexico was founded from the beginning as a Transparency International chapter.
Okay, so it's very expanded now, because 112 chapters, I think there are about 180, 190 countries in the world, so in the majority of the countries you have a chapter now.
Yes, exactly. We still have a few countries we have to cover yet, but luckily we are managing to grow. And you were mentioning also the advisory council. So this is also very important, because we have, as well as organizations, we also have a network of individuals, so experts and specialists who are individual members and who are also part of our advisory council, who also supports and give expertise as individuals. So it's quite a powerful combination of working in different countries with a central secretariat and with individual experts. That's also one of the reasons why I think transparency managed to develop so fast in what is actually not that long a time, right?
In a country where you do not have a chapter, you might have an individual who is looking into matters for you, because you edit something that's called the Corruption Perception Index, for example, and that's about 180 countries. So you also have information about countries where you do not have a chapter.
Exactly. So it depends a bit on which. We have many different tools and many different reports. And in some cases, these reports are written by a national chapter, or they use information which comes from one of our individual members. And this is the way in which we also can suggest local solutions, so local solutions to local corruption problems. At the global level, for example, the Corruption Perception Index, which you mentioned, is actually calculated centrally. It's calculated in Berlin, because what the Corruption Perception Index does is it looks at different existing measurements of corruption. So it's an index which is not calculated locally, it's calculated centrally. So that's why there are many different types of reports. For example, another interesting tool that we have, or service, is what we call anti-corruption legal advice centers, or we call them ALACs, and those are very much local. So these are local offices where, for example, if a person is facing a problem of corruption, they can go and get advice on how to deal with that issue. So again, the combination of global and local is what makes the organization quite interesting, right?
So what exactly do you do? You edit every year some kind of lists? Is that the basic thing you are doing?
Yes, I mean, it's actually useful maybe to look at this issue in stages. So in the beginning, in 1993, 1994, when there was not really much awareness of the issue of corruption and there were no ways even to measure it, the first thing that the founders did was firstly to generate these measurement instruments. So, for example, the Corruption Perceptions Index, and later they developed also other surveys, for example, asking citizens about their experience of corruption. So starting to generate statistics which allow academics and governments and different people and journalists also to have an idea of the size and of corruption and which sectors are most affected by corruption, for example. Together with that, a lot of the work in the early years was setting up international legal frameworks to fight corruption, because it may seem quite unusual today, but in the early 90s, in many countries, it was legal to pay bribes in other countries. You could actually deduct them as a business expense. So, for example, if a European company in Africa was paying bribes to get business, they could actually say, these bribes are a business expense and I don't want to pay tax on this business expense.
So what did they call them then? They didn't call them bribes, I suppose.
No, but they would use things like maybe, consulting expenses or, you know, the different euphemisms they could use.
Incentives.
This was actually not so long ago, right? In the early 90s, this was quite common. So one of the big early victories was actually in 1997, when the OECD, so the Organization of Developed Countries, actually put in place a convention, an agreement to outlaw this type of behavior, so to make it illegal to pay bribes in other countries. This was followed in 2003 by a United Nations Convention against Corruption, which again was a large agreement among countries on several different aspects of corruption, anti-corruption. And Transparency International had some part in this, in actually asking these organizations to take a stand and to put the legal frameworks in place, right, to help people to be able to fight corruption.
That's a good job. But you didn't do that alone, I suppose.
Exactly. I mean, from the very beginning, one of the things that Peter Eigen and many other speakers emphasized that we still do today is to work in coalitions. So Peter, for example, talks about the golden triangle of working with businesses, with governments, and with civil society organizations, and that it is only in this way that such a complex problem can be tackled. So, for example, right now, we are working with G20, so the most advanced countries in the world now have an anti-corruption group, which we are also supporting and working with. The World Economic Forum also has an anti-corruption working stream. And since Transparency International first appeared, many other organizations internationally have also, so other NGOs have appeared. For example, in Washington, in Brussels, in London, we have colleagues who are looking at different aspects of corruption, which is a huge problem. So it's really good to have a coalition of civil society organizations, international organizations, and of course journalists, right? So investigative journalists play a key role in fighting corruption and in uncovering individual cases. We often use individual cases to show how better laws are needed. So the individual cases that journalists uncover are really extremely useful and extremely important to the anti-corruption work.
Yes, and next to journalists, there are now the whistleblowers. I saw that you have a special page on whistleblowing on your website. This is also important for you that such people exist, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we actually recently published is a report about whistleblowing laws. And it's really important to have laws which protect whistleblowers. And in many countries in the world, the laws are not yet strong enough. So a person who finds a case of corruption in their office or in the government, for example, someone who's an assistant to a minister, let's say, and who really has a strong suspicion of corruption, if they speak out, if they try and go to their boss or their boss's boss, often these people, unfortunately, end up losing their jobs. So it's very important that there is whistleblower protection laws which set out some kind of protection for these people who are really taking quite brave actions in many cases, right, to speak out against acts of corruption.
Yes, it's a bit absurd that they are not more protected, of course.
Yes, absolutely. So this is also where citizens come into play. So, for example, one of the things that our chapters are asking their governments to do is to strengthen the law to protect whistleblowers and also, for example, to better political party funding laws. So one of the things that we see in many countries, also in developed countries in Europe, is that it's not clear who is funding the political parties, or it's not always transparent who is actually funding the political parties. And this is really a big gap in the system, because what we've seen over these years is that during election campaigns is when the relationships are often built with politicians and with people who will later be in positions of power. So when someone, for example, is funding your political campaign and supports you and this allows you to get into power, those favors are later, unfortunately, sometimes paid back as bribes or as giving someone special treatment to get a government contract, for example. So political party funding is another area where globally we see there's a lot of need to have stronger frameworks and stronger laws.
So I had a look at some of the maps and I see that you have data on almost all countries. I compared some maps and I saw maps from 2006 where some countries were white, which doesn't mean there is no corruption at all, but which means that you do not have data on those countries. And then some years later they appeared on the map and they were dark red, which was the darkest. So does that mean that countries where you get no data are very, very, very corrupt countries always?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's a good question because, as you say, data is key to even start talking about something. If you don't have concrete, hard facts or at least some data, it's very hard to even start working on a certain issue. And in the beginning, when we started working on this issue in 1993, 1994, there were very few surveys or studies which were looking at the issue of corruption. So over time, what we're seeing is that there are more and more organizations which are also starting to work on the issue of corruption. And for example, it could be that it has to do with the country's size. It doesn't necessarily mean that the country has more corruption if there is no data. It could be that it's simply a small country that isn't covered by many surveys. But luckily, as you say, the most recent studies, we've managed to find data for most of the countries of the world. But we really do hope to get better on that front and to have also more support, because we also have to face the fact that surveys cost money. I'm sure you know that even a simple national level survey is quite expensive. If you really want to ask 1,000 or 1,500 people what they think on a certain issue, that costs quite a bit of money. And if we want to do the same in 190 countries around the world, it really is also a question of funds and budget. So it's a mix of things at the end.
So that's how you get your data. You do surveys. You can hardly ask people if they have been corrupted or bribed or something, because all parties involved, of course, have an interest in keeping things quiet then.
Yes, exactly. You can't ask them directly, but you can ask them, for example, if they perceive that there is corruption on their country, for example, on a scale of 1 to 5. And we and many other organizations have been doing this for quite a while, and this type of approach, so an indirect approach, actually gives results which are quite consistent. And it's also interesting that our global corruption barometer, which is where we ask citizens if they have paid a bribe, and if it's anonymous, people often do tell us about it, because in many countries we have to remember that people have to pay bribes. So there are countries where, for example, to get access to a hospital, to get access to schools, to get the police to help you even, you sometimes have to pay a bribe. And often people do want to talk about this. They don't like the situation where they are forced to pay bribes to get what should be a very simple public service, or actually even a human right in many cases. So what we find is that more people actually are willing to speak about corruption and are willing to say, look, in this office and in this department, I was forced to pay a bribe to get access to a public service. So this is really a positive development. In fact, in our last survey, which we published, our most recent large survey, 2/3 of the people that we interviewed said that ordinary people can do something or can do more to fight corruption, which is a really encouraging development. So 20 years ago, there was very little awareness of what corruption even is, and now 2/3 of people around the world are telling us they can actually do something about corruption. So it really is quite a positive development when we look at it in the long term, right?
Have you ever been bribed? I mean, do people try to bribe people from your organization to change their data or something?
No, I think that would be quite a big mistake. No, I haven't had that experience, and as far as I know, neither have my colleagues, luckily, no.
So what sectors are more corrupt than others?
According to citizens around the world, political parties. I think this was universally seen. It's probably no surprise, but across the globe, from you know, maybe lower income countries to high income countries, in many of them, political parties were seen to be the most corrupt. The police, for example, also were seen to be the most corrupt institution in 36 out of the 107 countries that we covered most recently. And unfortunately, also public officials in general were quite often seen to be the most corrupt. So it depends, of course, which country we talk about. For example, in a couple of countries, the media was seen to be the most corrupt. So it depends, not in all of them, of course, but for example, in the UK or in Australia even, the media was seen by citizens to be the most corrupt institution, which is also an interesting result. But overall, political parties are by far the institution with the least trust from the public, let's put it that way.
I remember there was some kind of research here in our city of Antwerp, and as a result they said that the fire brigade had the highest trust. Do you find that on the international level too? I can hardly imagine that you have to pay a bribe for people to come and put out a fire.
Yes, that would be extreme. We haven't actually asked that question. It could be interesting to include in the next survey, but it's also interesting to look at positive examples. I completely agree that if we want to find solutions, it's always interesting to look at institutions and situations where things are working well and ask ourselves, what is that institution doing differently that makes people trust it more? Often, in general, people tend to look at problems and try to analyze only the problem when there are solutions, you know, right around the corner, for example, in the fire station. Yes, absolutely.
But in business, there are things that I heard, and I'm just curious if these rumors are confirmed by what you have found. I always heard that the construction sector is the most corrupt sector, followed by the arms sector.
Yes, it depends on the country and on how we measure it, but those are definitely two sectors which are seen to be corrupt. in particular in the construction sector in countries where there's a lot of public contracting. So where the government is, for example, you know, public works, bridges, highways, etc., this is definitely seen as a high risk for corruption area. Even in this area, there is now a construction transparency initiative. It is not led by us, but we are partners and we are supporting it. So one of the interesting developments in the last 5 to 10 years has been sector-specific initiatives against corruption. So, for example, another business area which was seen as corrupt or which had this reputation was mining and oil. So the
extractive
industries, right? In there. So in many developing countries, it was not even a secret. It was very well known that there were risks of corruption and that there still are risks of corruption in these sectors. So another initiative where we also had some role in, which actually Peter Eigen was, it's what he did next after Transparency International, he can never rest, was the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, which is asking companies to sign up to this initiative and to sign up to commitments to, for example, share information on the payments they receive from governments and the payments they make to governments, and to share information about their profits and their taxes that they are paying, and many different types of information which can help people to gain information and, for example, journalists to investigate, different people who are working in these sectors to have more information. And it's transparency, as we know, is always one of the best, or is the best antidote to corruption. So it's encouraging also to see that even in the sectors which have the highest risks, there are initiatives which are trying to do something about it, right?
Okay, so your work is having results, and your example is being followed all over the world. That's good news. Our time is already up, so I have to say goodbye. Thank you for being available on a Sunday afternoon. And lots of success. Maybe I'll call you again if there is some news about your organization that's international.
Of course, any time, and it's a pleasure to talk to you. And many thanks for your interest in this topic, which is really a big issue and still will be for the next coming years.
So it certainly is. You're
okay,
welcome.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.